The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn Beck.
You know, for the last few years, I've not changed my core. I know what I believe. I know these truths I find self-evident. However, there's, you know, what made me popular was that I was certain. I was certain. And you have to do this job, you have to be pretty certain about a lot of things. But I was certain. And in the last few years, I have lost what made me popular, certainty. And I have gained what has zero value today. Except to me. Humility or a lack of certitude. That's a good thing, I think. It makes it very difficult to compete in today's world. But I know what my core is. But boy, what we're doing isn't working. I have been looking for anybody who has had a moment of self-reflection. And I read one of the best stories on self-reflection I have, and possibly maybe the only one that I have read from journalists. But it is a great article, and it's written by Ben Smith. He's the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed. And it is, this is what it was like learning to report before fake news was the biggest problem in the world. And it is a piece on, wow, maybe I should have been less certain. Ben Smith joins us now. Hi, Ben. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Glenn.
You bet. This is a great article that I just haven't seen. I haven't seen from anybody else, and I appreciated it. And I wanted to start with saying thank you.
Well, thank you. I guess I must be the only person in this business ever to get anything wrong.
All right. So can you just take us through the story and tell the story?
Oh, sure. Yeah. When my first gig, like a lot of young reporters, when I was young and unattached, I always wanted, there's a romance in being a foreign correspondent, and I got a job the only place I could, which was this particularly obscure bit of northeastern Europe, covering freelancing for the Wall Street Journal and covering places like Latvia and Lithuania, and particularly Belarus, which is this medium-sized, kind of authoritarian-run country that never really left communism. It's the one place where they really kind of kept the system intact. And wherein this was the 2001, in fact, the election was the day before 9/11, September, 2 days before, it was September 9th, 2001. That felt like it was this historical anomaly. Everything was going one direction. Russia was going to become this free market democracy, and Belarus was this weird exception. And so all the Western reporters went there to report on what a weird exception it was. And there was all this stuff there that made no sense. There was this giant tractor factory producing what seemed like, many thousands of tractors. And if you'd go around the country, there'd be tractors plowing the streets. There'd be tractors sitting unused on farms because nobody could afford diesel. So I wrote this Wall Street Journal story kind of making fun of communist mass production. The biggest story I got was this young activist who told me that for this new kind of revolutionary group that was trying to, bring democracy to the country, who told me that the way they funded their group is every month he would go to Poland and pick up a suitcase full of cash from the Americans and bring it back to pay the bills. And this was a great scoop. This was big news about American foreign policy, and so I published it. And then the next time I was in the country, the deputy chief of mission, the sort of number two diplomat, confronted me and told me I had gotten this kid beaten up and thrown in jail with my carelessness in reporting what he told me.
And this is something that bothered you for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's something that sticks with you your whole career. You just think about, because I think, in journalism, it's hard to predict what's going to happen. It's after you reveal a piece of information. And I think, should you think about it? Should you not worry about it? Should you just be focused on essentially telling the truth to the people, to your audience, at the expense of your sources? These are hard questions, but I definitely thought about it and Googled the guy from time to time. His name is Alexei Shedlovsky. And then at some point, and I don't even know if it was translated right, ran across an interview with him where he said he hadn't been to jail for his beliefs, which seemed weird to me. And so I you know, I didn't really know what to do with it and sat on it for a while, and then finally found him on Facebook, where he lives in Prague and he manages a hotel. And I called him up on Facebook, and he said, "Yeah, that never happened. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't go to jail. The story was fine," which was really, you know, totally shocking to me. I'd spent years thinking this was this horrible thing I'd done to him.
But it goes further than just that. And you tell this story. I know we're pressed for time, so you're rushing through the story. But you please read this story. It is so well written, and you can feel. I mean, I love the line, and my face reddened even more. You know, as these things are being brought up to you over the years, you're just, it's grinding you and bothering
you. You know, I got everything wrong. The other detail, this tractor factory that I thought was such a joke, it was revealed in the run-up to the Iraq war that the reason that it was so large and so hard to figure out and kind of weirdly secretive is that they were making missile launchers and were exporting weapons all over the world. So I had totally misread the situation, you know, as you're apt to do, and you're apt to, you know, you kind of want to tell your readers what they want to hear sometimes. And I knew the Wall Street Journal readers would get a kick out of a story about how, you know, silly communists doing silly communist things, when in fact what this was, you know, a sort of hub in the anti-American arms dealing network.
Ben, you quoted Janet Malcolm, and you said the core of journalism is betrayal. What does that mean?
Well, you know, there's this famous little book called The Journalist and the Murderer. And I think, you know, I mean, journalism is a complicated business, and the goal of getting people the truth does not always involve, I mean, you know, it involves getting people to tell you things that's against their interest to tell you. There's this legendary story, a great novel called Fatal Vision. You know, if you like true crime, fantastic novel by Joe McGinnis. And he basically wrote to this man who was accused of murdering his family, told him that he was in sympathy with him, that he believed he was innocent, that he wanted to help with the defense, insinuated himself into the defense team, and then wrote a book about how guilty he was. And I believe the guy sued him. I mean, it was, you know, it was this very messy thing where he had really totally betrayed this guy, really tricked him into getting his confidence and betrayed him. And it was a very extreme case, but I think what Janet Malcolm argues in this very small book about how, but sort of the ethical complexity of journalism is that at some level, that's what all journalists are doing all the time, is betraying people's confidences in order ultimately to tell the truth to their audience.
And you are even betrayed, as you found out that when you met up with him, the guy you thought had gone to jail and was beaten up, you didn't know what to do with it for a while. And it just kind of sat with you, and you decided, I've got to find the guy who told that to me.
Yeah. And, you know, I called him, I left messages, I talked to his wife, I could never track him down. I finally got a hold of his boss, who said, "Oh God, he was always doing stuff like that. That's why he didn't work for me long." I mean, you know, after all these years, I wish I'd known that.
So you had gone through years of that.
It's also about, you know, trusting government. Like when, you know, people, government sources, official sources, diplomats tell you something, you know, your instinct, no matter how skeptical you are, at least mine as a young American journalist, was to trust them, and that was the wrong instinct.
And if I have the story right, you have kind of come to the place that you have to question not just the government, but you have to question everything that you think you know. It sounds to me like you're in the same place that I'm at on, I have to be less certain because I don't know what I know anymore.
Well, you know, the luxury of my business, of news reporting, even more, I think, than yours, is that we don't have to know things. We don't have to be sure. We can tell the readers what we found and let people make up their own minds. And I think it's, you know, it takes a certain amount of discipline to do that, and it's hard not to inject yourself. But I think that is all. That's ultimately what we tried to do.
But isn't that what, in some regard, that's what I should be doing as well? Where I do have to inject myself, but I don't have to. You know, we all have to remember. You know, we listened to everyone? Are we absolutely sure this is right? This is my opinion. That doesn't necessarily make it the only opinion worth considering.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends. It's the sky, you know, you can say the sky is blue and be pretty sure about it. But
yeah,
I think, but you can also realize people lie to you, realize, you know, and realize that your big assumptions about where things, how wrong those can be. I mean, that to me was the big thing. You know, we were all there laughing at this ludicrous dictator who was obviously a relic of history. And, you know, 20 years later, he's still running the country.
So, Ben, what is the state of journalism now?
That is a big question. I mean, I think, honestly, that it is better than you might hear from our president. I think there's a lot of great reporting being done. I think, you know, there's been a long campaign to discredit both specific journalists and whole topics of journalism that people don't like, you know, for their own reasons, and that's really left a mark.
You think that's happened on both sides, though?
But I think when people will say that they don't trust the media, but then if you ask them, do you trust your local newspaper? Do you trust the guy who writes about the Cleveland Indians for the Plain Dealer? You know, people mostly do. And so I think, but I think it's tough. And I think like our job is very much to try to win people's trust back to some degree. And I think that is in part by being transparent about what we don't know.
The testimony this week with Facebook and Zuckerberg, we are all now, I mean, when I first got into radio, this is 40 years ago, I had to build an audience. Now, my audience has an audience. Everybody has an audience. You know, you can accuse me of saying and doing things, you know, for clicks or ratings or whatever, but a lot of people are now doing that. That are just walking the streets and they don't realize that they're doing that. Where do you stand on what's happened this week with Facebook? What should be done, if anything?
I mean, I think it's really complicated. I mean, I think that, you know, Facebook has built this platform that has 2 billion people on it, and you know, there's no way that the people running Facebook Incorporated can really control something like that. I mean, I think people see them as like the government of Facebook, but maybe they're a little more like the United Nations of Facebook. I mean, just in terms of the scale of it. And I think, you know, when something really horrific happens in the United States of America, you know, somebody gets shot on Facebook Live, there's, it gets a lot of media attention, they deal with it, they promise to take it seriously. Outside the United States, in languages you and I and Mark Zuckerberg don't speak, I mean, every day, all sorts of crazy things are happening that the company is almost no way of telling what's going on. I think that, you know, it's very unclear what regulation would mean in an American context. The Europeans are starting to really impose new rules around your ability to own your own data, your ability to force places like Facebook to explain what they're doing, that I think may have ramifications here too. But I do think, in a way, everybody's waking up to these compromises we've made around our privacy and kind of reckoning with them right now.
Talk to Ben Smith of BuzzFeed. Ben, one thing from the story, to get back to it for a second, that you wrote, and we're going to tweet that at World of Stew at Glenn Beck, make sure people can read it, is I thought it was really interesting because it relates sort of to our world as well, in the talk radio realm, in that you felt the desire as a young reporter to essentially please your editor, right? Like to please the paper, to give them and what the audience what they wanted. And is that something that's you think common in your business? I know it's common in talk radio. I know it is. Do you find that to be common in the business? And also, how do you push back against it? Because it's got to be a very natural instinct, essentially searching for acceptance from your employer.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's your employer, there's also your audience, right? And you want to please your audience, but you also, I think, hopefully respect your audience enough to know that sometimes people actually want to be challenged and will trust you more if you do not always tell them what they want to hear. I do think, you know, it's interesting, you know, before the internet, you didn't really know, you know, particularly if you were a newspaper reporter, I think, you know, in some ways in radio, you didn't always know what your audience was thinking. And so you did very much write for your editor, for your publication. I mean, the big change to me was that when I got online, you know, the editor I cared about, whose opinion I cared about, was Matt Drudge or Josh Marshall or Andrew Sullivan or some big blogger who could link me. And I think more than people realize, a lot of journalists were writing for them, were writing for these kind of mega internet assignment editors who could drive a lot of traffic. And then that became replaced by social media and by, you know, can I get so-and-so to tweet it? Will this get me a lot of retweets, a lot of Facebook shares? And that can lead you, I mean, it can pull you to the extremes, the shrillest thing, the thing that most that plays most to a reader's prejudice is often the thing that gets most widely shared.
Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed.com. Thank you so much, Ben, and really enjoyed your article. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
You bet. Bye-bye. It's a really, this is a nuanced conversation because there are things that are true and always true. But there are all kinds of things around the edges that we argue about that, you know, maybe we should start listening to each other a little bit more and understanding what people are going through. And I say this to you, saying, I don't know if I've always listened to you like I should have. I have judged people harshly and without understanding and without listening. And that's not healthy for anybody.
Glenn Beck.
I think that Ben Smith article's a really important article, especially for young journalists, because he talks about don't write the things that you think the audience wants. Don't write the things that you think your editor wants. Don't write the things that are going to, you know, get you the lead story. Don't trust anything that you think you know. And that is, to me, a really good thing coming from a guy that a lot of young reporters look up to and are probably trying to please right now. Really sage advice. I want to talk to you a little bit about Bank of America for a second. It was Citigroup that came out about 4 or 5 weeks ago and said that we're going to stop doing transactions with people that are selling firearms to people under 21 that are high capacity magazines. We won't provide any banking services. So no credit cards, no banking, no loans, nothing. And I told you at the time, this is disturbing because there are really only 5 banks in America of any real size. And they are Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and not Lehman Brothers. Why do I keep saying Lehman Brothers? Goldman Sachs. Those are the banks. Now, Citigroup came out a few weeks ago and said, not going to do banking services to anybody that does those things. Okay. Bank of America has just come out and said the same thing. In fact, you need to hear the vice chairperson at the Bank of America yesterday making this announcement. This is remarkable. This is now the second bank, and they're saying they will not make any loans to firearm manufacturers. You're not going to have to repeal the Second Amendment. You'll just make it impossible through banking to be able to run a business, either making the guns or selling the guns. This is a constitutionally protected firearm. And the banks are deciding, no, we don't really care. We're not going to provide any kind of financial services. 2 out of the big 5. Back in a minute.
Glenn Beck. Mercury.
As someone who does radio for a living, it's very important to me that your ears are in premium condition at all times. They're very important to my livelihood. The fact that your ears are comfortable, you can actually hear the things going into them, it's very important to me. That's why I talk about WaxRx. WaxRx is a system to clean your ears in a way that's a lot more efficient than the way you've been doing it before. Before, there was this whole thing with Q-tips, and Q-tips kind of started to do other things and people started using them on their ears. That's not what they're designed for. WaxRx is designed for cleaning your ears. It comes with everything you need to safely clean out earwax and condition your ears in the comfort of your home. If you go to usewaxrx.com right now, you can order the reusable earwash system and you get to use the offer code radio. They're going to ship it to your door for free. When your ears aren't clean, and they can get uncomfortable. They itch. They can be painful and get plugged up, making it harder to hear. You don't want that. You want WaxRx. Go to usewaxrx.com, promo code radio for free shipping. Usewaxrx.com.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
After 2008, everybody knew we should break these big banks up into smaller banks, but what the federal government did was make the bigger banks, the biggest banks, even bigger. So we basically have about five national banks. We have five giant banks. We have Citigroup, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs. And if those five banks decide that they're going to do or not do something, it changes our world. Well, and I'm sure there's no one behind this. Citigroup came out a couple of weeks ago and said they're not going to provide loans or any financial services as Citi. They will not provide any financial services at all to any store or group that sells high-capacity magazines. Or sells to any gun to anyone under 21. There were a couple of other things. Now, I told you at the time, this is the way to get rid of the Second Amendment without ever having to pass a single law. You just get the five big banks to go along. Well, strike one was Citigroup. Strike two, yesterday, Bank of America. So now we have two out of five. Bank of America, here is the... Bank of America executive yesterday. Listen.
What's Bank of America's stance on lending to gun companies that manufacture certain weapons?
Well, let's just start with we want to contribute in any way we can to reduce these mass shootings. I mean, it's such a tragedy in the United States. So that's number one. We do have a few manufacturers of military-style firearms. We're in discussions with them. We have let them know that we are going to, it's not our intent to underwrite or finance military-style firearms on a go-forward basis.
So does that mean that you are going to get out of lending to companies that manufacture military-style weapons that's used for civilians?
Yes.
Full stop, 100%.
Yes.
Full stop, 100%. What is a military-style weapon? Can anybody tell me? Because I know in Afghanistan that could be considered a rock. What is a military-style weapon? One that looks fancy? One that is, you know, is black or camouflaged or green?
Long and pointy.
One that has a high-capacity magazine. What does a high-capacity magazine mean?
More than you'd need.
How do we define that? This is happening now at the banking level. If the bank, this is why cryptocurrency is so vital. Because if these five banks decide they want to do whatever they want with the Second Amendment, you're not going to be able, you won't have companies making firearms because they won't be able to get bank loans. Every business needs a revolving loan. The time that it takes to buy the stuff, make the stuff, sell the stuff, get the money back. They have to pay their employees, so they need a revolving loan. 30, 60, 90 days to pay their bills while that supply that they just made sells. How are you going to keep your doors open if you don't have a revolving loan? Imagine if Bank of America came out and said today, we are not going to be financing any of these news sites that deal in hate speech or violent speech. You could say, oh, well, that's really good. Someone smart in the room would say, wait a minute. How are you defining that? Let me give you an example. Coming up in just a few minutes, Donald Trump's biggest supporters. These are the self-proclaimed biggest supporters of Donald Trump. Diamond and Silk. Going to be on the program for the first time. Diamond and Silk. I think they're hysterical. They are 100% in for Donald Trump. But I've never heard anything dangerous from them. I've heard things I disagree with, but I've never heard anything dangerous. I enjoy them. I like them. I disagree with them. Facebook has decided to censor them through the algorithm. Well, wait a minute. I just heard the testimony. He said that they were only going to censor people that were dangerous or engaged in hate speech or terrorism. I haven't heard that from Diamond and Silk. Have you? The devil is always in the details. And the banks now aren't really revealing the details. They're just letting you know. Let me tell you something. If America doesn't pull its money from Citigroup and Bank of America and put it into Chase or Wells Fargo and tell Wells Fargo or Chase why they're doing it, we're going to lose this battle because you have two. It was nuts when I said this before any bank did it. It was nuts when I said one. It's probably still nuts now that I've said there's two. Guys, there's only five. There's only five big banks. You going to pull your money? Because when you get down to Goldman Sachs, you can't pull your money from there. I don't know anybody. I don't know where I find a Goldman Sachs branch. You've got JP Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo. They start down the same path of Bank of America and Citigroup. And they start saying, no financial services for these people. You're going to lose the Second Amendment. And you will lose it without a single vote in Congress or by you. So we've got a couple of stories that I just really want to get to. One is in Houston that we've been talking about for the last couple of days. We've just not had a chance to get to it. And the other is a remarkable story that Stu promises. I haven't read it yet because he's very excited about it. It's about a mother of five.
It's a wonderful family story, Glenn.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
It's
good.
A wonderful family story about a mom.
Uh-huh.
Her name is Jordan Smith.
Jordan Smith.
Yes.
I like Jordan.
She is a single mom.
She's a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
Mother of five.
I don't know if it's okay. A mother of five.
All right. Okay. Well, I may have read another story. About
yeah.
A mother
maybe.
Of five.
Mm-hmm. Now, she's held a variety of jobs to pay for her role as a single parent. It has its challenges, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
She has served as a cocktail waitress and an exotic dancer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of... She has actually just one teenage daughter, it looks like.
She has a teenage daughter.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Now, she has decided to... Because you could certainly ask for government help. You can go that direction, or you can go a different direction. The direction of this wonderful mother, Jordan.
That's probably a wrong direction. I'm gathering.
Are you for a big government? Is that what you're saying?
She
has signed up for a new website.
Oh, boy.
And this website is called What's Your Price? She is being paid to go on dates and maintain platonic relationships with men. It's totally wholesome. I mean, just to go out and hang out with somebody, it seems fine.
Sure. That doesn't sound like a good, solid business model, though. I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, I could make friends with, you know, women and...
Mm-hmm. First of all, we know that's not true with you. You could...
Well, I can't make friends with anybody.
No.
But you know, you that's not a hard... I mean, why would you pay for that?
Well... the men will either send her, this is her quote, men will either send me an offer or I can counter offer and I'll send them an offer of like $150 or $200.
Okay, so you know, this seems like prostitution.
I don't think. Did you miss the word platonic?
Yeah.
Because that's what that's what the word is
yes,
in the article.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know if she defines platonic like I would define platonic.
It's possible.
Nor the men.
It's possible that people have different views of this type of.
Sure. And we're open-minded, right?
Now, she says she can counter or they can accept the offer. It is a eBay-type service.
Hmm.
It's just like a bidding thing, but I don't do less than $100. Now, part one of this is an issue in that when you're announcing to the national media what the lowest price you will accept in a negotiation, the negotiation isn't necessarily going to go well because everyone's going to know you'll do this for $100. So why would you ever accept a $200 bid on whatsyourprice.com? That's question number one I have. Now, the arrangement is fairly similar, according to Yahoo News, to seeking arrangement. This is another site I'm sure you're familiar with.
Seeking arrangement?
Yes.
This is a flower?
It's a little different.
Oh, okay.
It's a little different than a flower site.
Okay.
It connects women with sugar daddies.
Sugar daddy.
Uh-huh. Or even comparable to being a prostitute.
No.
Now, some people, I don't know, you somehow pulled that out very early in the story.
Yeah, well.
But that's not what.
I'm pretty much an oracle when it comes to things like this.
Now, this mom insists that the process is different because of the lack of pressure and legality. She did sign up for the Sugar Daddy website. And that's one thing we do have to acknowledge.
All right.
She did sign up.
But she left that life of sin.
She said it was just garbage.
It was just garbage. Right.
It put a bad taste in her mouth. So she didn't have really high expectations for what's your price.
Right.
She was nervous because she didn't want the men to expect anything.
Sure.
But to solve that problem, she took an important step.
Mm-hmm.
She pointed out in her profile that it would be no strings attached. Now, I don't think
this is going to end well. I mean, if she is sincere in that, I have a feeling we're going to find her body in a dumpster at some point.
Well,
okay.
It's certainly possible.
Maybe behind the bar, we might find her body in a dumpster. But it's not going to work out well.
If you were going to a site in which dates were offered for cash.
Uh-huh.
And in the profile of the person, it said no strings attached. I think what you would think on that is it's sex without any connections afterwards, right? Like, no strings attached means the exact opposite of what she wants it to mean. Which is a huge problem.
Right.
If what you want is someone
who just is going to have sex and then there's nothing afterwards.
Right. You'd say, no, look, let's hook up. No strings attached.
Let's look at it another way. Maybe she's saying, I'm not a puppet of anybody and you can't tie me up.
That may be what she's saying.
Right.
However, she seems to not understand what the phrase means. These words may not think what you think they mean.
Right.
So...
You keep using that phrase.
It's what you think it means. So she now is saying that that's because she just doesn't want the people to expect anything. No strings attached means the opposite to that.
But she could get lucky.
You could. I'm quoting the Yahoo News story. What she's gotten out of the men she's gone on dates with is nearly $3,000.
Hold it just a second. Could I just have a sidebar here,
yes,
Your Honor?
Please do it.
Could you read that sentence again? This is from Google News?
Yahoo News.
Yahoo News. Okay.
What she's gotten out of the men she's gone on dates with is nearly $3,000.
Now, I'm not the queen, and I don't speak the queen's English, but I don't recognize that even as English.
Does gotten... get into a news story.
No.
I don't think it should.
Ill-gotten goods, if it's in quotation marks,
okay,
maybe.
I'll give you that.
All right.
But that amount is only increasing with a single more steady companion she's connected with. After a few dates with one man in particular, this mom says he's taken on a more substantial role in her life.
Mm.
From buying her a truck to giving her money... to buying her teenage daughter Christmas gifts.
Oh, dear God.
The 36-year-old's companion has given her $7,600 so far. Although their relationship is currently non-sexual, the divorced dad of grown children has been introduced to Smith's friend and her family. He's definitely unique, she says. He's always wanting to help out and wanting to help me succeed because I'm a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
He's taken me and my girlfriends out. My daughter's met him a few times. He's actually going to buy her a car.
Oh, you got to get... He sounds like a winner. Get your daughter in with him right away, because nothing could possibly go wrong. There'd be no trouble you'd be gotten into.
By the way, just to wrap up the story, in the meantime, she continues to date around the site and have some extra earnings, while also doing some part-time foot modeling on the side. Obviously, this story ends with part-time foot modeling.
I don't believe that story. I believe that is fake news. There's no way somebody actually wrote that story and it's true. That's craziness. Welcome to yet another day in America.
Thank you. Glenn Beck.
We are we're glad you tuned in. Thank you so much. Diamond and Silk coming up in just a second. Pat Gray is coming up. Also want to talk to you a little bit about the leadership training program. We did this last year at Mercury One, and it is remarkable. If you are 18 to 25 years old, Mercury One is opening up our library for a select few to research on original historic documents from our collection. We will also be teaching history. David Barton and his son are really heading this up. It's really remarkable. First week begins May 28th, June 11th, and then the last session is July 9th. If you would like to apply, there is a cost to this. If you would like to apply, mercuryone.org/LTP, leadership program, LTP, mercuryone.org, LTP.
Glenn Beck, Mercury.